Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. Palantir knows everything about you. That is the headline of a piece written by today's guest, Peter Waldman, and his colleagues Lizette Chapman and Jordan Robertson of Bloomberg. I'm guessing that most people have never heard of Palantir. It's a company founded by the billionaire investor and Donald Trump supporter Peter Thiel. Peter Waldman and his colleagues at Bloomberg report that Palantir cut its teeth working for the Pentagon and the CIA in Afghanistan and Iraq. They write, the company's engineers and products don't do any spying themselves. They're more like a spy's brain, collecting and analyzing information that's fed in from the hands, eyes, nose, and ears. Peter Waldman is an investigative reporter with Bloomberg News. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose.
Well, great to have you, Peter. As you know, as we always do on our weekly media roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention this week?
So beyond the obvious Trump headlines every day and the perfidy thereabout, I was looking at MarketWatch, which is an online economic and business sort of provider of news. It's published by Dow Jones. And they did a piece I thought was really provocative. It essentially gave a lot of data behind a problem that all of us live with daily in the Bay Area, which is housing and the scarcity thereof. They reported on a recent, on a yet to be released report by a couple of economic research outfits called Next 10 and Beacon Economics, and they show that more than a million people have left California between 2006 and 2016, primarily because of housing prices. And they give a lot of underlying data to show why, that the wealthy, professional, college educated, largely tech-oriented folks are moving in, but a whole lot more people of lesser means are moving out because of housing problems. And some of the data points that they provide are quite illuminating. Basically, about 25 new housing permits are issued for 100 new residents in California per year, so that you end up with essentially new housing going up at about half the rate of the national average, and that has a lot to do with permitting and other issues of NIMBYism in California. But they also say that by the year 2025, there will be 3 million dwelling units short in California for the population, and that California homeowners are paying 22% of their income for housing, which is 49th in the nation, meaning only one other state is paying more.
Wow.
And renters, who are obviously more numerous, they're paying a third of their income to rent a place to live, which is the third worst in the nation, the median rent being $1,375 per unit in California, or $1,375, which is 40% more than the national average. And they're saying that the highest rate of the nation in California is the number of people who have to share a bedroom with someone else. That about 15% of all renters are sharing bedrooms, which is highest in the nation. So it was really distressing litany of statistics, and again, it kind of gives some underlying data for problems that all of us are living in every day.
Wow, 15% of renters are sharing bedrooms. That's amazing, because 2/3 of San Franciscans are renters.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary number. It's by far the highest in the nation, they say. They say that the outflow of out-migration in the state peaked in 2006, and no doubt why. I mean, that was the peak of the housing bubble of the highest expense. I mean, it's only gotten worse, obviously, but the majority of people leaving make less than $30,000 a year, but California is a net importer of professionals who make higher incomes, so the balance couldn't be worse for renters and other people who aren't making a fortune.
Hmm. Well, and housing is a huge issue with the elections coming up, both here in the Bay Area and then in California in November. Well, that sounds like a piece that's full of data that we'd love to get our hands on, MarketWatch. And we'll find that article and then link to it right after the show. Peter Waldman is an investigative reporter with Bloomberg. Thank you for that one, Peter. Peter, before we dive in and talk about your very lengthy investigation about the company Palantir, I just want want to ask you a media question. Given that Cambridge Analytica has received international headlines over the past couple of months, what do you think about reporting overall on data mining, besides the obvious angles? I mean, we've been talking about, if you've been online or in tech since, you know, the late 90s, we've been asking these questions about privacy for over a decade. But what's new in the reporting now just about these data mining companies?
Well, I don't think any of us quite understood the dimensions, the scale, the scope of what data mining, and there are other terms that sort of are aligned with that. They mean different things, but the obvious one, artificial intelligence, which is the ability to sort of analyze that data algorithmically, and of course, machine learning, which is to basically describes how computers can teach themselves, can accrete modes of approach and adjust their own algorithms according to all the data they're seeing. So what we're experiencing now, and Cambridge Analytica sort of brought it to everyone's attention, but it goes far deeper and wider than that, and Palantir, which we'll discuss in a second, is a great example. But we're seeing now the kind of almost everyday sort of quotidian application of data mining and AI and machine learning, such that our lives are touched at almost every turn. And the obvious ones are when they send you an ad based on an email you sent somebody else, and you may have been talking about wanting to take a vacation on a raft or a river, and suddenly you're getting ads from river, you know, and that's all algorithmically driven. We've experienced that for a while, but what if then, you know, you start getting phone calls from outfitters or from guiding companies, or, you know, that's a relatively benign example, but that's the kind of thing that this extraordinary depth and reach of our online activity is leading to. And as far as the coverage goes, you know, it comes and goes. You have to really seek it out. I mean, Wired obviously covers this stuff in depth. We try to at Bloomberg Business Week. We've had a number of stories of late, including ours, but we've also done a big YouTube cover. We've done a couple of Facebook covers in this period of time. And, you know, you have to go to publications that care and are looking into that and perhaps are a little bit celebratory about the evolution of some of the technologies.
Well, I was going to ask you, when Mark Zuckerberg testified on Capitol Hill, there were a lot of criticisms of the politicians who clearly just don't understand how these platforms work. Do you think that journalists understand? Because in many cases, you kind of have to really cover these companies on a regular basis to really understand how these systems operate.
Oh, I think that's a very astute observation. There are not a lot of journalists who do cover this stuff regularly. I think journalists, as we skew younger, are involved with it and using platforms that are engaging it. And very frequently, I will add, that journalists can have our jobs eased or aided and assisted by these kinds of tools. I mean, particularly investigative journalists that find themselves and have access to databases and perhaps teams of computational journalists on staff who can really help with deep dives. It's more of a tool of the trade than it is a subject of the trade.
The piece you and your colleagues wrote about Palantir is 14 pages printed out. It's a lengthy investigation. And I'm guessing that a lot of people either have not heard of Palantir or don't know what it does. When did you first learn of Palantir?
Oh, boy. I've been hearing about Palantir for years just because I live in San Francisco and have covered the Valley some, although less than my colleagues, because I'm more of a generalist and an investigative reporter than I am a tech reporter. But it's something that it's hard to avoid in journalistic circles or newsrooms going back now, I'd say, 6 or 7 years, mainly because, and I think this was somewhat intentional on their parts, they created a real mystique around themselves, partly by just being very unavailable and very cloaked in what they do and what their activities are. So it's piqued a lot of interest in the journalistic community. But one of the other ways one hears about it, especially if you're a parent of college-age kids or are a college-age kid, is that it's a magnet for talent. This is another sort of effect of the mystique they've created, or the halo, really, was that kids who are studying tech or coding or related topics get out, and many of them hear about Palantir as this place to apply, that they put you through this multi-stage interview process with puzzles and games and test your intellect, your logic, your ethics, I might add, because they seem to care about that in the hiring. So you hear about it from young people who are at all interested in tech because it is this destination. Of course, you know, 98% of them don't get hired, but it does have this aura.
And Palantir, as you report, was co-founded by the billionaire venture capitalist Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is one of the only people in Silicon Valley who decided to publicly support Donald Trump. He contributed $1.25 million to the campaign, according to reports. He's dined with Trump at the White House. He was also in the documentary, which is really, really interesting, about the state of journalism. It's called Nobody Speak, and you can watch it on Netflix. And it looks at why Peter Thiel decided to finance Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker. It ultimately led to Gawker's bankruptcy. What did you learn about Peter Thiel? What do we need to know about Peter Thiel?
Well, he just turned 50. He's a legend in the Silicon Valley, both as an entrepreneur and mostly as an investor, a venture investor. In terms of his entrepreneurial direct experience in tech, it goes back to the founding of PayPal, and with a bunch of others who went on to fame, founding other companies. They became the kind of PayPal mafia. He's a leading member of that. He sold that company and was a very early investor in Facebook, and remains on their board and has an enormous shareholding of Facebook, which has created his assessed wealth, or estimated wealth by Bloomberg, of about $3.2 billion. He's gone on to invest in all kinds of things through multiple venture funds that he controls, some investing his own money, others are traditional funds of lots of people's money. But one of the companies he founded back in 2004 is Palantir. And he did so for a purpose that I think anyone at the time would be happy to hear about, which is this was the aftermath still of the 9/11 terrorist attacks from 2001, and we were fighting these wars most deeply in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as the so-called global war on terror. And his notion was, we can use some of the algorithms, some of the software developed at PayPal for tracking fraud and predicting who might commit fraud in the security realm. And he came up with this data mining company that they named Palantir, after the all-seeing, omniscient stone. He did this with a number of very high-powered sort of computing professionals down there. They say they wrote the first platform for Palantir software in about 3 weeks. And off they went, and they sold it, leased it to the Pentagon, the CIA, and other security three-letter agencies in Washington for the war on terror. It was actually a hit in some respects in Afghanistan and Iraq with commandos. I interviewed a Green Beret commander who said it was head and shoulders above anything else the Pentagon had available to them for so-called battlefield situational awareness. What it does, essentially, the Palantir platform, as you described, as you read from our piece, that it's the brain of this analytic, deep dive mining, deep web probing software, and it essentially links together a myriad of distributed databases, whatever the client or Palantir can find to probe, so that you will have it, say, in a battlefield context where it proved so effective, you might have sort of other military observations codified, let's say, in visits to a village along a road connecting two cities in Iraq, for example, which is where it was used widely. And those, that information, those points about how literally houses along the side of the road where Al-Qaeda sympathizers might have taken up residence, or there might be a family living there, will be in one database of sort of battlefield intelligence. Then they'll have video surveillance from helicopters and maybe even satellites of a given area in a different database, and another database just on the U.S. deployment in that area, and on and on and on with these various databases. And what Palantir does is link the connected information across all of it. So you might put in somebody's name, and you will see that person was known to visit this village, possibly making them a Al-Qaeda sympathizer. You might get a video shot of the actual house that person visited. You might get a picture of the traffic from some other source, military sensors put along the road showing the traffic in that area. And it's all meant to help planners, let's say, decide where they might set a roadside bomb. So they used it for things like that. They also used it to target suspected terrorists in the drone attacks that we know were so numerous in that period of time. So Palantir was widely used overseas.
Peter, how accurate is this technology? And as a journalist, are you able to get your hands on that information? How would you know how accurate it is?
So nobody knows how accurate it is, because in what you're really, your question is implying the kind of next phase for Palantir, which is how it came back to be used in our country, right? So you have this tool for the war on terror that was then deployed back in the United States, and we'll go into that, and that's where the accuracy for all of us is very, very important. Because police departments and sheriffs and the Department of Homeland Security and all kinds of other agencies, as well as private companies, are using it in the United States on Americans. So they essentially weaponized a tool built for the war on terror for Americans. In terms of the accuracy question, just keeping with the sort of overseas period of time for Palantir, let's call that the 2000 knots, right, through 2010 or so, when they were so successful with the Pentagon and CIA, we dug up, we did interviews with defense community analysts who were involved with the use of Palantir in targeting suspects for assassination because of terror ties. And we know one horrible story where they were tracking someone and went right up to the edge in terms of ordering a kill, and the analyst went back to the Palantir people and said, wait a second, you've done something with the database here that seems to have created name conflicts, that there was an Abu in that name that's no longer there, and yeah, this is, you know, whoever, but it doesn't have the Abu in the name anymore. What have you done? And they said, oh yeah, we merged those because we thought it would be easier. And to make a long story short, they were targeting an innocent person for assassination, and that was sort of one of the chilling stories about the accuracy question. It was actually sussed out and prevented because of the human element at the end, which is very, very important, is to have sort of human judgment in the chain. Anyway, we can talk a lot about accuracy issues and civil liberties and privacy in terms of the, you know, domestic use of the tool.
Peter Waldman is an investigative reporter with Bloomberg News. Peter and his colleagues have a lengthy piece out called Palantir Knows Everything About You. Peter Thiel's mining data company is using war on terror tools to track American citizens. The scary thing, they write, Palantir is desperate for new customers. If you have any questions or comments for Peter Waldman about his reporting, and overall, what are your thoughts about all of the articles that we're now getting about companies like Cambridge Analytica, Palantir, data mining, privacy? What questions do you think reporters should be asking? There's a lot of money at stake here and a lot of our personal information. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we talk about how Palantir is used here in the U.S., you write that the military success of Palantir led to federal contracts. Are you able to get your hands on that? How much money are we talking about? And are these no-bid contracts? Are government officials who make these decisions doing their homework?
Well, we can get some of that detail, and there was extensive litigation when the Army chose not to use Palantir, and Palantir accused them of developing a proprietary system when the law is supposed to require them to take products off the shelf, so to speak, and use vendors like Palantir, and Palantir prevailed in that lawsuit, so the Army has gone back to Palantir, by the way, under the Trump administration. I have no idea whether Peter Thiel's relationship with Donald Trump helped in that, but we do know the Army has returned and will be using Palantir for this product that they were seeking, in one of these intelligence products. Anyway, there's more public information available about city contracts and other local law enforcement. There have been a number of successful FOIAs, and we know, for example, the Cook County Sheriff in Chicago is a big user of Palantir. We know a very large user of Palantir, and there was quite a wonderful study by a Princeton PhD student of the Los Angeles Police Department's use of Palantir for so-called predictive policing, and we've got contracts and things there that we have been able to dig up. So there is some of that documentation, not enough, frankly. We know just in the Bay Area, in Oakland, a privacy commission that the city council has set up is very concerned that Palantir is being used by the Fusion Center, which knits together all of the police and local law enforcement with the feds and their various DHS and FBI and so forth, and it's housed and based in San Mateo, but it's meant to cover the whole Bay Area to fuse and blend and share information among levels of law enforcement as an aftermath of 9/11, of course, because everyone figured out that, you know, they weren't sharing, which is one of the reasons that terrorists were able to do what they did. So they set that up, and Palantir is a major and an obvious provider for the Fusion Center because it does link so many disparate data sources in one platform. Mm-hmm. So this privacy commission in Oakland is very concerned and wants to look into that. And there's a movement that the ACLU has spearheaded to get jurisdictions all over the country, in states essentially, but also local jurisdictions, to pass laws that would require more disclosure and actually require approval by elected officials before law enforcement agencies contracted to use things like Palantir and other surveillance devices. Right now, a lot of the funding for that sort of stuff and for all kinds of, you might call, militarized policing activity comes from the Department of Homeland Security into grants. So it's federal money right into fusion centers and police agencies and so forth. And it bypasses the local city councils and boards of supervisors and others who normally have oversight over law enforcement in their jurisdiction. So the ACLU has recommended in California, there's an effort, but also elsewhere, to pass laws that would say, before you use or make a deal with Palantir or other surveillance providers, we need to sign off.
Peter Waldman and his colleagues at Bloomberg report that police and sheriff's departments frequently ensnare in the digital dragnet people who are not suspected of committing any crime. And if you'd like to read this piece, Palantir Knows Everything About You, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Peter Waldman is an investigative reporter at Bloomberg News. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from Washington. With your host, Joshua Johnson. Among the topics on this week's news roundup, is the Iran deal dead? More on the recent attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, and on the China trade war. That's at 11 here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Joining us now is Peter Waldman, investigative reporter at Bloomberg News. Peter and his colleagues wrote a piece called Palantir Knows Everything About You. Peter Thiel's data mining company is using war on terror tools to track American citizens. The scary thing, Palantir is desperate for new customers. And let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for a very good program as usual, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the platform, not exactly Palantir, but it's related business. We have been reading about the fact that Cambridge Analytica is going bankrupt, and specifically I have a question about them. Well, what do you know about this bankruptcy situation? How bad is it for them? That's my number one question. And the next question has to do with this. What role have they played in the elections in the U.S. in 2016, and specifically the sort of support they have given to the Trump campaign? These are my two questions. I'll take your answer on the air. Thank you
very
much.
Okay. Thank you, Max. Nice to hear from you. Peter, what about Cambridge Analytica filing for bankruptcy?
Well, they are, as you said, filed for bankruptcy. They don't appear to be doing business anymore. I think that is the result of tremendous adverse publicity in their home country of the United Kingdom. Your listeners probably know that their CEO was caught on tape in a journalistic sting operation, coming up with all kinds of dirty tricks and deceit and deception and just horrible things in what he thought was a client interaction. So that has really done them in, I think, over there. It's less related, I believe, to what's happened over here, which of course is that Cambridge Analytica was an important tool of the Trump administration's and helped profile voters for both to get the conservative base to vote, but more importantly, I think, to suppress voters, to get information into the hands of potential supporters of Hillary Clinton in 2016 and discourage them from voting. There is a Palantir connection here, by the way. We have testimony from the British Parliament by a former Cambridge Analytica person who became a whistleblower, who says that a Palantir employee was the one who helped Cambridge Analytica come up with their scheme, or the person who provided Cambridge Analytica with the Facebook data on some 87 million Facebook users in the United States, and the Palantir person assisted Cambridge Analytica in that. Palantir tells us that that person was rogue, that they had nothing to do with Palantir. When they did that, they did it on his or her own. Hard to assess. Palantir has said that about prior scandals when they were proposing to go after liberal opponents of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is, of course, a very conservative, corporate-oriented entity in Washington, D.C., and Palantir and two other companies pitched their outside lawyers on a whole campaign of dirty tricks. And when that got exposed by an anonymous hack, capital A on anonymous, Palantir said, oh, that was a rogue employee, and we suspended that employee. So we've heard the rogue excuse before. Hard to know what to say about their relationship with Cambridge Analytica.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Max. Oh, Max also wanted to know, did Palantir have any role in the 2016 elections?
Palantir itself does not work for political candidates on political issues. They have a policy about that. Palantir's founder, Peter Thiel, who is still the chairman of the company, as you mentioned in the opening, contributed $1.25 million to the Trump campaign. He is a self-described libertarian and loved Trump through that period and spoke at the Republican National Convention.
Business Insider is reporting that the power players behind Cambridge Analytica have set up a new data company. The daughter of Robert Mercer, Rebecca and Jennifer Mercer, have joined Emmer Data on March 16th, but it's shrouded in mystery. Alexander Nix, the suspended CEO of Cambridge Analytica, is also a director, as well as other executives from a parent company called SCL Group. Have you heard about this, Peter?
Well, sure. I mean, I should say, not say sure. Actually, I had not read that Business Insider piece. I know that SCL Group, which was the parent company of Cambridge Analytica and had, I believe it's a $10 million investment from the Mercer family, who are big backers of the Trump administration, they were the ones, SCL is the ones who owned Cambridge Analytica. So it would make sense that the parent company and some of those individuals would move on and try to continue this work under a different title. So that could be what we're seeing there.
All right, and we'll link to that piece right after the show. Peter, I know we have to let you go. What would you say to users who are kind of overwhelmed, I'm sorry, citizens who are overwhelmed by all of this information? I mean, people like using various platforms, their phone, Twitter, Facebook, what have you. And a lot of people don't share, well, a lot of people do share a lot of information, but what is the best advice you could give people who are concerned about all of this information getting out there and getting into the hands of companies like Palantir?
So I'm not in a position to give advice about, let's say, you know, shutting down your Facebook or anything like that. That's kind of outside my role as a journalist. But I would say that spend some time looking into what the ACLU and other groups are really trying to do about this, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and so forth, because there is a growing understanding and concern among the civil liberties and privacy communities about what's happening and a whole bunch of legal initiatives. So get behind that. I know the state of California has one. As I mentioned, Oakland, there's stuff in Seattle. There are initiatives around the country that would give elected officials more control over some of this stuff. But on the subject of sort of how to manage your social media and all of that, short of unplugging, I'm, you know, not the one to really give advice.
Well, Peter, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Have a great day.
You too. Peter Waldman is an investigative reporter at Bloomberg News, and you can find his story, Palantir Knows Everything About You, at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to mark the 25th anniversary of World Press Freedom Day. Joining us is Dr. Courtney Raj, a journalist and advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Courtney Raj is author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. Hi, Courtney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, UNESCO's theme for this day is Keeping Power in Check, Media Justice and the Rule of Law. And the Committee to Protect Journalists consistently documents attacks on media workers and journalists. And sadly, these are very dangerous times. Just this week, 10 Afghan media workers and journalists were killed in Afghanistan. And then every week we're hearing about a journalist killed or injured by Israeli snipers in Gaza. What a time to have the World Press Freedom Day. But Courtney, what does freedom of the press mean in today's times?
Well, sadly, the press are under pressure really as never before. We're seeing historic levels of journalists being imprisoned for their work. 2 years running now with 262 journalists behind bars in our most recent census. And what we see is, a broad trend of deterioration following on the war on terror in 2001, which led to this trend of journalists who are covering terrorism or terrorist groups being equated with supporting terrorism themselves. And this got even worse after the so-called Arab Spring. And now with the role of technology companies, the importance that, these platforms play to journalism, we've seen that governments are increasingly cracking down on the press, both physically but also in terms of the expression online. So with the U.S. also ceding its leadership role on these issues, it just looks like things are getting even worse for journalists around the world.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists around the world today, nearly three quarters of all journalists jailed are being held on anti-state charges. Which countries are the biggest violators?
So Turkey is the leading jailer of journalists worldwide, with at least 73 journalists in jail on our last census. And that's pretty shocking given that Turkey is a vacation destination for so many, Americans and Europeans. And it is technically a democracy. China is the second leading jailer, and Egypt comes in at third. These three countries actually account for more than half of all journalists in jail worldwide. So, if we want to do something about this, we could certainly focus on improving the situation in those three countries. All of the journalists in jail in Turkey, there's a huge crackdown after the failed coup. They're all being charged with these anti-state charges. And we're also actually seeing an increase in the number of false news charges, which are being used to crack down on legitimate journalism. And so, the anti-press rhetoric emanating from the Trump administration is certainly not helping the situation.
That's definitely right. I wanted to ask you about that. How has Donald Trump's hostile rhetoric against the media affected, maybe given ammunition to authoritarian states to increase their attacks on journalists?
Well, that's precisely it. It has provided ammunition to authoritarian or repressive states that, frankly, they don't really need an excuse to crack down on journalists. They're already doing it, but this provides them greater cover. So we've seen that rhetoric being used in Egypt, in Russia, in China. China's MFA, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, saying that they're welcoming the recognition that fake news is a problem. It's something that they've known for ages. Well, China regularly tops the list of the world's leading jailer of journalists. But we're also seeing it in democratic countries, like in Poland. We're seeing it in Myanmar, where the officials there have dismissed the reporting on the attacks against Rohingya, which the UN has called a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, as fake news. We saw President Assad in Syria dismissing reports of human rights violations there as fake news. We saw Cambodia kick Radio Free Asia out of the country using the same excuses. So we're deeply concerned about the demonstration effect that that's having around the world.
Now, you all track this very closely. When you have 73 journalists in jail in Turkey, for example, and thousands report being oppressed, censored, and under threat, how are you able to communicate with these journalists to find out how they're being treated in jail and to find out what they're charged with?
So that is not actually an easy process, and that's why we do an annual census. And we're actually not able to provide, real-time, up-to-date numbers because, perhaps not surprisingly, the authorities are not exactly forthcoming about why they're putting people in jail or even providing documentation And frankly, a significant percentage of journalists are in jail worldwide without any appropriate charges being filed. But what we do is we work very much like a journalistic organization. We have correspondents around the world, and we have a team of regional bureaus based in New York, and they investigate each and every case, and they're looking at whether that person was doing journalism. Are they being retaliated against because of their journalism, and really trying to dig to the bottom? So this may mean going in country. We have a network of sources around the world. And of course, we're also using the latest in digital technology, such as SecureDrop, to receive information from sources securely and anonymously as needed.
Today, we are joined by Dr. Courtney Raj. She's a journalist advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. Can you talk also about how 9/11 and the so-called war on terror has been deadly for journalists? A record 185 journalists have been killed in Iraq. I mean, they're getting hit by all sides, unfortunately.
So unfortunately, the war on terror has been deadly for journalists on multiple fronts. On the first, you know, obviously journalists are being killed in crossfire and just on for reporting on hostilities. But, you know, they've also become props used by terrorist organizations like ISIS to, you know, propel their own agendas, and they have been murdered by those who are, you know, when they're investigating corruption or investigating the organized groups in Iraq and in Syria. So there's a range of threats that journalists are facing and literally getting killed because of this. And you would think that most journalists, I think most people would think most journalists are killed because, you know, they're caught in crossfire or covering war. But in fact, most journalists are murdered. And what we've seen is that not only is the Iraq war and its multiple, you know, facets over the years been deadly for journalists, but the war on terror, the response to Iraq and 9/11 has been deadly and has also led to journalists being jailed across the world, because we saw, as I mentioned before, the idea that, you know, covering terrorism is somehow equated with terrorism. And we've also seen that that governments around the world have been happy to use the excuse of terrorism charges and, you know, the journalists who are doing independent reporting or critical reporting, charging them with terrorism or supporting terrorism as a way to restrict independent reporting and maintain their hold on power.
Right. Iran just shut down Telegram, which is a very popular instant messaging app. Russia is trying to do the same again. And again, it's all framed on this so-called war on terror and national security rhetoric. In our remaining 10 minutes, Courtney, let's talk about what's happening here in the United States. According to the Global Press Index, the United States has fallen two spots and is now listed as the 45th ranked country for press freedom. And much of that is due to the rhetoric we hear from Donald Trump. But how can we make sense of this? The United States is now 45th for press freedom.
So, yeah, I mean, Reporters Without Borders has their own methodology. I can't really comment on, you know, how they decided to rank countries, but I can certainly talk about the situation in the United States, because we did a joint mission with Reporters Without Borders and the other global press freedom organizations. For the first time ever, we did a joint press freedom mission to the United States because we were so concerned about the conditions here on the ground. Usually we're doing these missions to places like Azerbaijan or Turkey. However, what we found, we went to Missouri, Texas, and Washington, and what we found is that the media are under extreme pressure from a variety of things that actually started before the Trump administration. So, for example, the threats to media increased under the Obama administration, which brought more charges using the Espionage Act than all presidents combined to really crack down on whistleblowers. We saw that the ability of journalists to report is undermined by the economics that are, you know, squeezing the media, causing local journalists and news organizations to really have to thin their ranks, but also that their ability to report on protests is becoming very difficult. They're being undermined by attacks. from both the police as well as protesters, because, you know, everyone wants to take their message directly to the public and not have it filtered through an independent analytical lens. And so journalists are often being, targeted, therefore. And also we've seen that things like the Department of Homeland Security's pulling journalists out at the borders, you know, really targeting them at the borders, asking about their sources, taking their devices, searching them. You know, there's a whole range of things that started under previous administrations but have converged under this one, and the anti-press rhetoric, the constant pillaring of the media has really inflamed the situation.
Right, because this didn't start with Donald Trump, but now it's on overdrive. And I'm thinking about a former New York Times journalist James Risen, who wrote a piece called If Donald Trump Targets Journalists, Thanks Obama. He wrote this in December 2016. Mm-hmm. And, you know, James Risen was dealing with a lot of issues with the Obama administration when he wrote his book about whistleblowers, about government secrecy. I mean, the list is very long. So this didn't start with Trump, but can you talk about how it's escalated over the years?
Sure. And, you know, Jim and I work together at the New York Times, and he is an amazing journalist. And, you know, the type of what he said is absolutely accurate, is Obama set this precedent of going after whistleblowers using the Espionage Act and going after journalists. Now, Risen was ultimately not required to testify, but this, you know, this sends a chilling signal to sources and journalists around the country when they're being brought on espionage charges. And we have heard from journalists and reported on the chilling effect that that has. What we're seeing under this administration, I heard, for example, from a journalist covering the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, that it's actually harder to get information out of that agency than it is out of the CIA.
Wow.
There is this real tendency to try to control information and only allow journalists, for example, to talk to public affairs officers, not allow them to talk to the experts. And the Society of Professional Journalists has done a lot of reporting and advocacy on this issue. But, you know, this administration has restricted access to journalists. It's also targeted individual journalists and individual media outlets by name. You know, having the President of the United States come out and attack journalists on Twitter, in the media, has had an impact on the safety of journalists. We've seen an increase of trolling. My colleague documented an increase of trolling against journalists who were targeted on Twitter by the president. And there have been other reports by, you know, other organizations in the space who have looked at the impact on Jewish reporters, on minority reporters. So it's really having, you know, a pernicious effect. The whole trolling issue has really increased. So it's this combination of the official, the official side as well as the unofficial actions that is creating a very pernicious environment for journalists in this country.
Courtney, it's really frightening and incredible to hear you say that journalists are having a harder time getting information from the EPA than they are the CIA. Can you give us any other insider information like that that we're not really hearing about that we need to know about?
I think, you know, one of the biggest issues that we're seeing is journalists who are having to, you know, continue their beat reporting. And it seems like it would be an issue, you know, it's a beat, whether it's the National Science Administration or, you know, the Center for Disease, the CDC, you know, just trying to get basic information and facts and talk to the experts who know the specific issues has become harder. And there are these directives that have come out that, you know, can imply that the whistle, you know, that anyone who speaks to a reporter may be retaliated against. And that's really, that causes a chilling effect. I heard from reporters at a panel we did at the National Press Club that they've had a lot of challenges just having basic conversations with government experts. And I think what's forgotten is that these government experts work on behalf of the U.S. American people. They're hired, you know, by the American taxpayer money, so their responsibility is to speak. We also heard, for example, when we were in Missouri, that the governor there has avoided giving press conferences, but gives the appearance of being open and available by holding online chats with constituents. But there's a fundamental difference between a press conference and a social media exchange. A press conference opens up an official to unscripted questions, questions that are being asked by reporters who have deep knowledge and follow an issue that, you know, a constituent or any social media user might not have that same depth of knowledge or expertise. So it's very problematic because there's this veneer of access and accessibility that is actually not real. And what we heard is that the governor was using, for example, Snapchat to communicate with people, and then those messages would disappear. And so then they're not able to be FOIA'd, you know, the Freedom of Information Act. They're not able to be seen. And so I believe that there has been now a ruling handed down that, you know, any communication, regardless of platform, you know, needs to adhere to the guidance of, you know, the rules on preserving information by government officials.
Courtney, we have about a minute left. What do you say to young people who want to get into journalism about what we're facing right now?
I say journalism is such an amazing profession. It is so rewarding and so interesting. You get to learn on a daily basis, but you have to be prepared. When I went into journalism, I went to the Middle East, I had no idea about safety, about what I needed to prepare to keep my information secure, to secure my communications with sources, to make sure that I wasn't creating And so I think that despite all the threats and the challenging environment, that there is also a greater recognition that journalism matters. And I know when we were in Missouri, the university there said that they've seen an uptick in journalism applications. So hopefully I would encourage all young people to think about a career in journalism.
Dr. Courtney Raj is a journalist, advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, and author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. Courtney, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the Committee to Protect Journalists and the report that Courtney mentioned at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also subscribe on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and any feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. David Latulipe is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you for joining us.